Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to the New Books and Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Rosh Balkar, and more importantly, I have the pleasure of welcoming back to the podcast Dr. Lori Patton, who is president and professor of religion at Middlebury College. We'll be speaking about a fascinating publication called Who Owns Religion? Scholars and Their Publics in the Late 20th Century. Lori, welcome back to the podcast.
It's wonderful to be here. It's a different role that I'm playing. I'm not doing life histories and life journeys and things, but I'm thrilled to be able to talk about the book.
Yeah, it really is a fascinating book. And I think it has a very fascinating genesis that you lay out in the introduction. But for the listeners, how did this book arise? Where did it come from?
So you're right about this in the first chapter, and it's sort of the only way that I could launch the book was to begin to write about that experience, which was in 2002-2003. I was a chair of the religion department at Emory University, and one of my colleagues had reissued a book, Paul Courtwright, on Ganesha, in which the publisher had chosen a cover that was offensive to members of VHP, RSS, and other Hindu activist groups, and perhaps people who were not members of those groups as well. And it was an Indian statue, and it was so therefore it was a surprise, I think, for folks to have that there. And it also drew attention to the content of the book, which included psychoanalytic studies of particularly Ganesha, and certainly looked at what we would call in the West the psychosocial and psychosexual dynamics of mythologies. And it was the early days of internet petitions, and it became a global petition against the publisher, OUP and OUP and Motilal Banarsidass in India. And there was a lot of discussion about what to do and how to withdraw the book. And it became the petition online became very vituperative, and then violent threats were made. And as a result of that, we needed to figure out what to do about this petition. Again, in the early days of how you manage these things, we began to figure out, and I was asked by the university to figure out which were straightforward exercise of freedom of expression protests, which were protests that were ones that involved what would be called non-actionable threats, which were using the third person, even if it involved violent actions. And the third were actionable threats, where the pronoun, the second person pronoun, you, Paul Courtwright, will die as a result of this book. And so those were the things that kind of made me realize that scholars had not been trained to think about this question of the public impact of their book in an age when their readership was really shifting. More and more people could have access to the book as a result of the internet, and more people could have access to opinions about books, many of which were scholarly, many of which were written by scholars for scholars and included scholarly asides that may have been humorous for scholars among scholars, which of course walked right into the imbalance that we were feeling very keenly and still feel far less so, thank God, in terms of the role of Hindu voices in scholarship about Hinduism. And so it was kind of a perfect storm in many ways. And as I sat there and collated like what parts of the petition were actionable, which were non-actionable, and which were just straightforward expressions of opinion, I thought maybe this is something that we need to think about and create a kind of Overton window. Is it possible to discuss these in a way that doesn't create more fear? As I began to just write about it, and that's helpful about any given writing project, you just write and then see, you know, who's interested in reading. I began to think about ways in which that case could then be thought about in the context of many other cases in the study of religion. Three of which out of the six case studies that I use are related to South Asia. And I began to lecture a lot on my thoughts about this. And I certainly can share more about those. And people really wanted to hear and wanted to talk. And I did work in Egypt and in Wisconsin and a number of other places. And I felt that people really needed to talk about this from all different perspectives. And I thought, okay, this is a book worth writing. So that's the genesis of it. I could say much more. I guess the only other funny story I'll say is that a friend who I was having dinner with in Pune many years ago, I was telling him about this book, and he said, well, it'll either be a really helpful book or it'll be a solipsistic book. It'll be, you know, one that's so self-involved with the critiques of the scholars within the field and the, you know, so forth. And I said, well, that's a fair warning that I should try to make it so that it's not a solipsistic book. But the joke in the family became, oh, Laurie's going to write her solipsistic book. So lots more to share there, but that's a note of humor and a note about persistence and creativity.
It's particularly humorous insofar as while writing about the extent to which the public reception and the public access to scholarly works, the extent to which that work itself would be accessible to the public.
That is, yes, you nailed it, Raj. That's exactly it, which is, and this was part of the, you know, thank you as always for beginning your conversations around, you know, kind of creativity and journeys in creativity, because in this case, there were three or four points of fear, you know, for me, not fear. I wouldn't say that. I would, if I were fearful, I wouldn't have written it, but just, you know, how are we going to move in these spaces? The first is, you know, not just one controversy, but try six, right, in terms of the case studies. But they were all things that emerged in the 90s, which is why the focus is, you know, scholars and their publics in the late 20th century. They all emerged during the emergence of multicultural awareness and the culture wars as we have inherited them now, as well as the role of the internet and the kind of utopian expectations of the internet in the 90s. And so that was one thing. So the controversial nature of things. The second is, even if there was, you know, the book was published literally 20 years after many of them, sometimes a little bit longer. So there was a element of historical assessment that made that less of a problem. But then the second worry comes in, which is recent history, right? You're writing about things that are, you know, committee meetings where people remember who said what and so forth. So it's not, you are working with an archive, but you're working with live memories as well. The third is just the nature of the public square. You're writing a book about the public square in the public square. And it was new kind of writing that I was trying to do. I knew I wanted scholars to be an audience, but I also wanted it to be readable by someone who was kind of generically interested, or folks from one field who wanted to read a case study about another field. And then the fourth and final thing is, I'm so used to writing about ancient India or even contemporary women Sanskrit scholars that I just wanted to be really clear. Like, I had to learn Habermas and respect Habermas and really put myself in that tradition. And that was also exciting to do, but also terrifying, because if I was going to write a book where most of the sources were in English, it better be really, 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 really good. Because in my world, in my view, the way that you wrote books that were compelling to people is to really translate and be in the Sanskrit source as well. So I figured I needed to do the same thing, only from English to English, you know. So those are the four forms of fear, or not, again, it's the wrong word, but
concern, anxiety. Perhaps.
Concern, yeah. And then, you know, as I lived into it, I kept saying to my editor, oh, I have all these other projects, but I'm still writing. And I was, but it was always the book that kept, you know, being harder to write. I work best working on multiple projects at once. And then I finally, you know, I'm sitting actually in the place where I, in Maine, where my family is based, and right at this table, I finished the book. And I think what helped me finish it was a sense that the issues weren't going away, and also becoming a college president, where you are in fact responsible for the public square in a whole new way. And, you know, I had some experience and I wanted to say some things about it that felt like I had a unique vantage point from which to say some of these things. And so that kind of oddly enough compelled me to finish it. And I think Habermas and his best critics, and he engages with his critics in a beautiful way, Max Penske and other folks, would they want this to be out there to engage with? And I thought, okay, you know, that is what I want. And Nancy Fraser, who's one of the theorists and someone who's engaged with Habermas, taught at the New School. I wrote her when the book was done, and she was just really thrilled that, you know, someone had taken up her work. And so, so I'm very glad that I persisted, but it is a story of long persistence.
Well, it's, I find it's a fascinating work, but also I'm so often interested in the story behind the story, you know, the upakhyana, or the story behind the person behind the work. And really, so few scholars, I think, would perhaps have the opportunity or the courage or the impetus to venture so far away from a well-established core expertise. But also, I mean, so few individuals within the academy would have probably both the interest and the scholarly skill and the positionality of the institutional awareness. I mean, you have a particular perspective. You know, one could have that perspective, and many have, who may not have the impulse to communicate with the public or colleagues or to work out this problem. But I think it was the stars aligned insofar as you saw a need and you wanted to address it, and you understood so many pieces of this equation that very few souls at the academy could have produced this.
Yeah.
But please go ahead.
I appreciate you saying this. I think what I have particularly loved about the responses have been a couple things. One, or a couple of the scholars who were either objects of case studies or mentioned wrote to say that they felt that I had represented the situation fairly. They didn't say, you know, in sympathy with any given group. But that has felt really rewarding, because I wanted to make sure that the dilemma of the academy and the scholar of religion in the academy was particularly written about fairly and empathetically. The second thing is, I've used it to teach now 3 or 4 times at Middlebury, and also in graduate seminars and things. You know, people ask me to lecture on it frequently, and since it's been out. And I have found two things. One is it's really effective teaching tool. I think it's also being, which I wasn't expecting, and people are using it in their graduate theory exam lists, you know, for graduate PhD programs and things. And I think that the one graduate student said, it's made this book was scary, but it also made me feel relevant. You know, I thought, yeah, that is really true, you know, that there is a different story to forays into the public square. And I think now the courage that it takes to be in the public square is really important. And one of the things that of the main points of the book is we must train our scholars to learn how to deal with the public responses. And I think we're better at it than we used to be in graduate programs, but we're not there yet. And so the way I put it is, and I have a really Catholic view, scholars can write whatever they want. They can be knowledge for knowledge's sake, diehard folk, you know, whatever the community's response is, you know, doesn't matter at that one end of the spectrum to the only thing you can say is something, you know, that the community would agree with, and you have to be completely embedded in the community, and that's the only thing that's needed. And I think each community is going to be different in that space. As you know, my view is that you can say any, you can write a well-argued, the scholarly standards still apply, you need to write a well-argued piece, but you have the right to do all of that well, but you do not have the right to be surprised when people react the way they do. Like, that's one thing that should shift, that there should be understanding of implications. And I have a list at the end of the book about what questions are important for scholars to ask about their publics, about their university support for freedom of expression, about their university's understanding and their department's understanding of the work they do, and so on. All of that, I think, is incredibly important for scholars to ask before they begin to write, not as a form of self-censorship, but simply as a form of preparation.
It's so fascinating. I think this must have been about 15 years ago at some conference somewhere, you know, they all blur in the back of your brain. And a colleague of ours was talking about the work of Jeffrey Kripal and the fallout and et cetera, et cetera. And what I was essentially communicating, or hopefully communicating, what you had just said, on the one hand, to a certain standard, you know, I mean, it's good work. It's all the work. It's excellent work, depending on your perspectives and your, you know, your sort of scholarly bent. On the other hand, what does one expect? I mean, clearly, this is going to be provocative on some level, and that's, you know, how could this not be provocative? I mean, so it was sort of that sort of social, public, emotional intelligence that I was advocating for, to be used in tandem with the intellectual rigor, not one at the expense of the other, but they sort of need to go hand in hand. And more, this whole podcast conglomeration called New Books Network, the largest podcast platform in the world, is what? It's aiming to bridge this quote-unquote ivory tower public divide. It's what we live in a world where, for good or for ill, everyone is or can be part of the conversation. And we need to be mindful of that. The other very quick footnote that I wanted to mention is, you know, the time it took to sort of churn out the book amid probably 1,000 other projects, you know, it created probably some very useful distance between the events and the reflection upon the events. And a silly parallel, perhaps. I think it's Peter Morgan in The Crown. I mean, he refused to go beyond 20 years. He ends the story of Elizabeth II 20 years ago.
Yeah.
If anybody watches The Crown, he's like, nope, we're not doing anything in the last two decades. And
yes.
I think perhaps that's a questionable decision on a storytelling level, but on a sort of a sociopolitical level, it was probably quite wise.
The right one, yeah. Oh, you're bringing up so many important points. The first thing, you know, just back to this question of recent history, the first thing that I have noted when I taught it at Middlebury the first time it came out really in early 2020 rather than in 2019, but publication date is 2019. And so I the next fall was the earliest I could teach it. And I just taught the book. It was in, we were open for COVID. It was fall of 2020. We were all masked and but it was a glorious class. I didn't recognize any of the students when we had to do one Zoom class because I never saw the lower half of their faces. But I do remember so vividly the students going, one of them said, you know, these feel kind of tame as cases. And I just laughed at it. It's true, you know, given what they were used to, what they had grown up in the time I wrote the book, right? Like not during the time, they in the actual time period from, you know, 2003 to 2020, they had become adults. They were born around that time it happened. And then they what they had seen for internet engagement and attack and counterattack and defense and all the things that create what I call in the book an eruptive public space versus a rule governed public sphere. That is, you know, that they learned the eruptive public space in a much different way than we did. They found, however, to your point, the case studies really instructive for all sorts of reasons. And I think that, you know, your ideas about that, you know, the analogy with the crown, it was a really interesting discussion because a couple of reviewers, you know, again, really thrilled with how the book has been received and was prepared, you know, myself for folks being pushed back. But because the controversies had died down, and there had been different ways of resolving the issues, that itself is interesting. Each case got resolved differently. There is more of a historical kind of focus, but the reviewers, one of them said one, well, actually more than one has said one wants a sequel. You know, what do we think now? And, you know, it's interesting. I can't decide. And the other thing they say a lot is now that you're, you know, college president for 9 years, what do you think, you know, you have to give us the solutions. And my solution was those list of questions at the end about what it means to enter the public square and to be prepared for the eruptive public space if that happens. And so, but they want more than that. They want me to, you know, say a whole bunch of other things. And I won't, because my perspective is that one needs to be Catholic. And each one of these cases is so different. So Raj, one of the things I did, my dogs are present and I have very little, in Maine, I have no buffer between me and the dogs. So if the dogs are barking, I apologize. You can edit some of this, right?
It's an animal-friendly podcast. We're good.
It's an animal-friendly. Okay, good. So anyway, what I would say, clearly Suka, my dog, agrees with me, that I did an exercise with the students in which I said, okay, as you read each of these case studies, how do you relate to the actors? Do you relate to the scholar? Do you relate to the people that have been, hang on just a sec.
Suka, come on, sweetheart. Come on. Yes, you, thank you for protecting me.
How do you relate to the actors? And some, you know, absolutely related only to the scholar, some only related to the community members who were objecting, some were in between, but every time the case, the people who voted one way, or I said they identified in one case, did not necessarily feel the same way for all six cases. They actually felt really different. So it was, because it was historical, to your point, it was a litmus test for how people thought about things. So for example, the Native American case with Sam Gill, was people really did not identify with Sam Gill and they identified more with the Native Americans. So my job was to say, hey, you know, how, let's think about where Sam Gill was coming from. Let's put ourselves in, you know, his shoes and so on. And then with the Roman Catholic case, which was Jane Schaeberg, a lot of the women, you know, were more identified with Jane Schaeberg. There were several Roman Catholic students who were men just by accident in the class, all brilliant Middlebury students, who were really not comfortable with what Jane Cheberg wrote. So that was really interesting to watch that kind of split. And it in each case, it was different. And I thought that was fascinating because it shows you in a much more pragmatic and down-to-earth way, case-based way, where how your allegiances are different and the complexity of being an American citizen. So I think that those case, the historical value of those cases allowed students to insert themselves in the best way and to show and study themselves in terms of their own identifications and values in new and important ways and ways than that were easier than had it been a contemporary controversy where people were still hot under the collar and sort of, you know, ready to go and play and so on. The other thing I would say is each of these cases requires an ethics, right? That I don't let students off the hook with having an ethics of engagement with the public square, you know, and I let them have any ethics they want, but they have to have them. And that I think is incredibly important to, you know, push on students. Like I have them, I will land in particular ways. And my ethics is about creating the best possible dialogical presence for people from whom we differ. And that in some ways can mean directly confronting content that, you know, we differ on, and sometimes can mean doing something else entirely, but doing it with people that you disagree with. And that's what I call pragmatic pluralism. And it's really an important value. So I'll share that with students. So I think it was helpful. The historical element over time really helped students think it differently. I don't know if the same approach would have applied in the Crown or not. We probably can relate to the Crown a little bit differently from 20 years ago than now.
Just a couple of the threads in what you were saying regarding the questions that you ask in the end. Listen, the reason Socrates is brilliant is not because he ever gave anybody any answers.
Yeah, you know? Well, that's true.
He doesn't give anybody any answers. He just knows where to point us to figure it out for ourselves. Yes. The other thread is that the various perspectives and the various stances upon which your various students, you stood, they it bespeaks the extent to which these issues are complex, and they really properly received really defy a binary or simplistic or zero sum game analysis. And I think part of what I was alluding to earlier in terms of your positionality and the, you know, your expertise in religious studies and you're obviously both theory savvy and you're excellent with people and your institutional knowledge, but your swabhava, I mean, you have the temperament to hold space for discussion in pairs of opposites. You have the sort of, in my perspective, what do I know? But I think that's crucial. A crucial piece of what you're doing in this book has to do with one's outlook in life and the extent to which one leaves space or believes space should be left for these various vying perspectives. Why don't we talk a little more overtly about what is it you advocate in the book? What does the book argue? Who owns religion?
Yeah. So the basic idea is that we, as a result of this confluence of multicultural awareness and debate from the 90s onwards and the advent of the internet, we have an entirely different reading situation in our hands and an entirely different public square, which would create the conditions in the 90s for what we call the eruptive public space, even earlier than that, but certainly coming to intensification in the 90s. And that eruptive public space is particularly difficult for scholars of religion. Scholars of religion exist with different patrons, matrons, if you will, university on the one hand, but we are not and have never fully succeeded in being integrated into the academy. We still have colleagues who say, wait, what do you teach again? And why can't you just be in history? And all those kinds of questions. And those are real questions that people have to confront. And on the other hand, we are not necessarily fully embraced by the communities that we study either, because we're part of the academy, right? So sometimes we are, but sometimes and frequently we're not, because we have double allegiance. So I thought a lot about, well, the role of the scholar is such that there is a kind of at least double, if not, you know, triple or quadruple allegiance. And what figure in culture actually fulfills that role? And the figure that came up to me is the wise fool. You see it in the Vidushika in Sanskrit drama. You see it in Shakespeare's Twelfth Night. You see it in so many different classical areas. And that was incredibly important to me to think about. And so given that there are so many multiple ways in which we operate, we should name it. We should talk about that, as fools are often scandalous. In theater, in literature, and so on. And that's a good thing, right? If you actually think about the definition of scandal, it's an obstacle, it's a tripping point. And it has been in medieval times, it meant a gross, in addition to those meanings of, you know, an outlandish story, it is also a gross irrelevancy to the court. Like, and some of the controversies is like, well, that's completely irrelevant. People would accuse each other of being irrelevant, which I thought was really interesting. It kind of scandal recovered some of its name. And controversy, you know, literally, you know, turning against, and people who were previously connected would be turning against. So there's a sense of a break in the community. So all of those terms are things that religion scholars should embrace, and should embrace as part of their identity, and should train for. So that's the basic argument of the book. And then you look at these six different arenas of where the eruptive public space emerged, where the lack of a rule-governed engagement happens, and which get really scary. And then thinking about in each case, what happens to the public square, and what happens to the rule-governed public square, and what happens to the public space. And I close, you know, I do a Native American case, I do a Sikh case, I do a Hindu case, I do a Ismaili Muslim case, I do a Hebrew Jewish case, and a Christian case. And then the broader perspective is to say that in training, we must have a theory. There's no good theory of religion without a theory of the public square. And there's no good theory of religion without a theory of the university, because both of those entities will determine how we conduct our scholarship. So that's the basic idea of the book. And yeah, but I can say a lot more, but yeah. Go ahead.
Sure. I'm sure you can. I'm sure we could fill easily a few hours diving into it. And so I'm sort of censoring maybe four out of every five question or thought that comes to mind about the book.
Too.
But I, you know, my job is to ask, you know, purposely naive questions, I suppose, and to point to the features of the book. One thing that really resonates about the book is how extremely big picture it is, and how extremely timely it is. Because what are some of the major considerations and deliberations afoot implicitly and explicitly, but for, you know, what is the public sphere? What is the public square? What is the scope of social media and speech thereon and engagement? What is the academy? What is the role of humanities? What is the future of humanities? You know, what is the relationship between the public and the academy? You know, what is the, you know, there's so many key issues that are being talked about or thought about in the process of generating this book. And I think that's why it's hitting so many, I want to say nerves, but there's a better word. It's sort of hitting so many points of interest with people. I mean, there's a number of questions. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I think you're right that it, you know, it's only become more relevant. What I worry about is the fact that it was scary to be part of the public sphere then. It's scarier now, and yet so necessary. And I think You know, you may or may not know that Middlebury's got this large grant in conflict transformation, and one of the skills that we're trying to teach students and learn ourselves as we build a learning community every day is the idea of scaffolding conversation, which builds trust, right? So you don't, in the first part of the conversation, say, hey, you know, what do you think about, you know, what happened to Jeff Kripal or Sam Gill or the Hindu critique and, you know, the Penal Code 295A of the Indian Penal Code that will hold people accountable for maliciously hurting the religious sentiments of folks in India and so on. You don't jump in there and try and resolve. You actually begin with very low, small expectations, which are and topics. And what do we think about? What is your experience with Hinduism? You may have lived it your entire life. You may have never heard of it. That the only goal of this conversation is that, and we're going to spend an hour on that, and then we'll think about what we do the next class, or session, or whatever it is. So it's a very simple concept. People in politics use it all the time in deliberative dialogue, but it's a way, scaffolded conversation is a way of building trust that is really different than we all know conversations as professors, as teachers, as podcast folks and so on that have gone bad because our expectations were too high and we were trying to do too much. And we forgot about the human relationship that needs to be built in between. And so that is something that I think is incredibly important to engage with. And if you look at the Sikh case, one of the cases that I discussed at Harjit Oberoi at University of British Columbia, that was one of the mid 90s cases. There were different kinds of dialogues. But none of them were ones that were committed over time, step by step. There was, you know, a much more explosive sense of what the Sikh theological community demanded and felt it needed, and what Harjit Oberoi as a secular scholar demanded of himself and his audience and his readers and felt he needed. So those are the kinds of forms of dialogical structure that I think are necessary today that frequently don't happen. And that's one of the implicit things that I talk about in the book is, well, I ask very explicitly, you've got to consider your public spheres. Are they micro? Are they meso? Are they macro? How do they think about, are they church basements? Are they Hindu temples as well as classrooms? Are they not? Are they CNN? You know, and there's huge range. And that consideration is really important because American Academy of Arts and Sciences, you know, did a study that showed that, you know, 98% of the work that is done postgraduate for any college graduate is in the humanities. Because they read the newspaper, they read books, they go to Bible study, right? If you think about humanities and public humanities in a different light, you are immediately relevant. And these case studies in the book show that with this new readership, you are immediately relevant. And with that relevance become, you know, comes responsibility. So I begin actually in public humanities conversations from a space of high relevance because I redefine what public humanities looks like rather than why is my, you know, I could use myself as an example, my book on ancient Indian mantra and sacrifice, not immediately taken up by every single person that is interested in, you know, speech and religion or something like that, which that's not a constructive question to ask. But a constructive question to ask is, what are the publics that might engage with this? And that was my second book. That's a really interesting example because that was the most obscure book I ever wrote. And I write in very obscure areas from a public perspective in some areas of the work I want to do. And yet the yoga community, I kept getting these letters from yoga people like, wow, I really love the way you're thinking about imaging in ancient India and it's helped my yoga practice. And I'm like, this is like the delight of thinking about your publics. It was sheer delight. Like, And I loved your chapters on mantras about roads. And I'm just like on the floor with laughter and excitement, not laughter as in, you know, laughing at the person, but just like, wow, I would never in a million years have thought this. So there's stuff like that that I think public humanities folks have been saying for a long time, but I think scholars, they need to, as I say, not dwell in the ivory tower, but shake hands over an ivory fence. And when you do that, the people that reach out to you and that you can reach out to are almost infinite in terms of the work that you do. I'm as you can tell, I feel very passionately about this, but I hope that answers your question or your comment.
Oh, the questions are all generative. They're meant to be generative. Mm-hmm. And so whatever mm-hmm. comes. That's fascinating. I think one of the real points of synergy, I feel whenever we talk, is the real respect for and value of the public and relationships in general, and this sometimes fraught relationship between academics and the public or their publics. And you know, it's kind of ironic. One of the people that comes to mind is Russell McCutcheon, who obviously has various ideas on locating agency within, probably more so within the scholar of religion in terms of doing their due diligence. And yet he's writing a manifesto and published with responses called Beyond the Discipline on the Future of Earning a Humanities PhD. And he's calling doctoral granting programs to reimagine what a PhD is for.
Yeah.
So given the fact that it's not the question of not being able to get a job, it's a question of jobs not existing.
Right.
And there's no shortage of brilliant people for whom there simply are no jobs. And there's no shortage of need in the public sphere for expertise on religion. So right. He's sort of calling departments to include insights or to train graduates on more public facing careers. And, you know, I find myself really fascinated by this whole, that's another way in which this book, another huge theme that this book is touching on and resonating with, which is the future of our discipline, the future of humanities. And I think that this, the public academy relationship plays a crucial role. I can't help but think that all of the pundits who pontificate on religion on the global stage, like who have the largest audiences in a seemingly or supposedly or allegedly secular sort of intellectual manner, take that with a grain of salt. None of them have taken a semester of religious studies.
Right.
No one knows what religious studies is. People
right.
don't think, hey, let me get a religionist to feel these
yeah.
questions. It's
yeah.
And so I, you know, clearly something we need to somehow, you know, clearly there's a messaging or marketing issue with our discipline. And I think works like these are will go a long way towards, I want to say, helping the discipline not even stay relevant, but to evince the relevance that is already there in our discipline.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, what's more important than religious studies? I mean, what's more
right.
important than understanding religion on a global stage? And yet no one knows we exist or what we do. This is a problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting thing to think about. And I know, I think there's so many different ways to address it. I think a couple of thoughts. First of all, Russ McCutcheon was someone I engaged with in the last couple of chapters of the book. We don't agree on everything, and we agree on a lot, and particularly around the question of engaging with public understandings of religion. I think we come at it from different perspectives, and by virtue of corresponding around these very questions, he's become a very a dear correspondent, a dear colleague, and we talk a lot about kind of how we think about these questions. And I would say a couple things. So first of all, I do think that people. I think the future of America is in the local and in the county, the parish, you know, however we might think about that. I think that is where our imaginations lie. And I think that there's this thing that I jokingly talk about, which is, you know, public engagement is the CNN, you know, element or the CNN fantasy. And a lot of scholars have a CNN fantasy, which is, you know, all of us do at a certain level, which is suddenly, you know, your scholarship becomes relevant. There's a discipline and an ethics to public engagement and to public scholarship that is, and a rigor to it. So when people do go on CNN, they're like, whoa, this is a lot. I have to do X, Y, and Z to prepare. Or I have to, you know, the reporter doesn't understand my questions and so on. It's like, yeah, it involves really careful translation and representation. And, you know, as someone who works in higher ed, there is never a media story. Maybe I've seen three in my time that has really understood what has been going on any given college campus, but certainly on our own. And because that's not the role of media representation. The role of media representation is to tell a dramatic story. I guess I'll give them that. But what I want to do with scholarship, many people feel that all of the subtlety of their in-depth scholarship should immediately be understood. It doesn't need to be translated. The reporter or, you know, writer or whoever should immediately understand that. It's not their job. It's not their sector, and it's not their motivation, and it's not their incentive structure, right? So instead, why don't we as scholars take different levels of public engagement and think about what that could look like? And so I remember very vividly when I was at one university where we were talking about, someone said, well, the administration is making us do public humanities now. And I'm like, so what's wrong with that? And I said, well, because, you know, next time you have to do a lecture in a church basement on, you know, the Hindu gods, then you tell me how happy you are. And I'm like, actually, I'm doing one on Friday, you know, in a church basement. And I love it. It's really fun because people ask really cool questions that you really have to be on your toes to answer. And so, you know, it was this moment where I thought, okay, I'm not getting what the concern is, but I think it has to do with an understanding of public engagement that doesn't involve discipline, that the discipline of translation into a public square where you actually can translate the subtleties of things. You just have to do it carefully and with commitment and over time, rather than the instant translation, you know, of what I do, or dumbing down, right? And so if you can actually make religion and the study of religion accessible if you stay with your chosen audience over time. So my chosen audiences have been Jewish communities in Atlanta when I was at Emory. We have a town gown society in Middlebury that I speak to regularly. We have, and then there's the sort of intermediate space. There's the state space. Vermont is a particularly wonderful state in, you know, inviting scholars and thinkers and people to speak and talk in front of legislature and so on. It's, you know, not as big and intense as some of, like a New York, but it's fun and it's really important. And then you have, you know, the other spaces all around that really, if you don't create a learning community, you're not going to be able to translate yourself to the public. And if you don't see public scholarship as a discipline in its own right that involves rigor, you will never be relevant and you will never make yourself relevant in the way that one needs to be. So I think that there are really interesting opportunities for us in thinking through these questions. And I also think the pragmatic element, I work a lot with Eboo Patel and folks who think about, you know, religious pluralism. In every hospital, in every social work situation, et cetera, in every corporate, the workforce requires religious literacy. So to your point, and to Russ McCutcheon's point about creating different kinds of scholars, those kinds of consultants could work day in and day out all around at all levels of American society, especially if they embraced the power of the local as one of the ways where America could be transformed and got rid of the CNN fantasy, right? It's like, great. It's not that that's a problem. It's just that that is going to do less at a substantive, profound level than the work at the township level and at the county level. That's the way I think about how we become relevant again.
Fascinating. One, I know our time is limited. I could talk to you for hours. One final question. What now? What are you working on now?
Oh boy, what a great question. So I'm doing, I think I mentioned this before in our other thing, and I'm still working on a couple of those projects. I'm doing a life history of the Buddha in poetic form from the perspective of plants and animals. I'm still working on that very slowly. That's going to be one of those long projects, but I'm about halfway done with that. I think the last time we spoke, I was maybe a quarter of the way done with that, but I dropped everything and have just finished, and it's now with readers, a memoir called The Long Dying. My dad passed away in June, and it's about it makes the argument that death should no longer be understood as a moment. It should be understood as a stage of life in which, like an adolescence almost, in which we have the opportunity to engage with our parents and their dying selves differently than we ever have before. And I kept telling stories about my parents and my siblings, and I've been taking care of my parents for 4 years now. And each year there was a hilarious story that related to their dying, and they were completely in love with each other. So they were able to die as much as they could together for several years. And everyone said, oh, you have to write this. So every story, every chapter is a story, and it's grounded in a myth, an ancient myth of some kind. So I use a lot of my interest in mythological stories to share stories about my parents dying. An example would be my father loved to take my mother out on dates. She had no working spine. She was demented and she had cancer of the leg. And he found a contraption to help take her out on dates while he could still drive. So two summers ago, they would go everywhere and go to restaurants, and everyone just loved them. There was this very twinkly couple, and wherever they went, people loved them. And I was with them on several occasions, and they would go to places in Maine like the Muddy Rudder or, you know, the Marsh Cafe. And if you look at ancient depictions of chariots, you know, the car was a central part of their lives together as lovers in the 50s and then newly married people. And if you look at the chariots and the idea of the power that chariots evoked, the first depiction of a man and a woman in a chariot together is in Amarna in the kingdom of Akhenaten, in the ancient Egyptian kingdom of Akhenaten. And they would be going in the chariot together to the marshlands of the farther reaches of the kingdom of Amarna. So like this is an ancient idea that my parents were kind of embodying in a 21st century way. And so those are the kinds of stories that I tell about both them and my relationship to them. Bottom line is, could we, as we think about the plasticity of the brain as we age, can we also not think about the plasticity of the heart? Because my mom is like the sweetest. She was not sweet growing up, and she's now incredibly sweet. And I'm like, wow, I have 4 or 5 years of a sweet mom. I am going to take advantage of this and pretend like I'm, you know, 1 year old again and think about what it's like to have that relationship. So I wrote it really intensely, you know, during breaks between meetings and other things. And it's now out with readers. So a friend of mine, dear friend, said at this stage in life, your priority is to do what you love. So I said, okay, I got to do this. So it was a real project of love, and it's just finished. And so that's different than the last time I spoke with you. So
beautiful. Well, we'll certainly have you back on for whatever publication you'd like to cover in future. Thank you very much for appearing today.
Well, I loved your questions as always. So insightful. And I just so appreciate all that you're doing. And whenever I get the notice of the New Books podcast, I always get through about 10 minutes before I get interrupted, but I always start every single one of them. So
wow.
Thank you. Great. Thank you again.
You're most welcome. For those listening, of course, we have been speaking with Dr. Lori Patton, professor of religion and president of Middlebury College. We've been speaking about fascinating, far-reaching, and exceedingly timely publication, Who Owns Religion? Scholars and Their Publics in the Late 20th Century. Until next time, keep well, keep listening, keep safe, and keep contemplating the power and maybe even the ownership of religion. Bye for now.